The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was a busy week for economic reports. PPI and CPI coming in hot, hot, hot. And we have lots of listener questions to answer on this show. All this and much more on episode number 497 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a great President's Day weekend holiday to you. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for being here today and each and every week, where we talk about finance and investment and markets, economies, and things that will hopefully help you make some money in the markets, get you more educated on the areas of investing and some of the nuances thereof. No guests today, but we are going to have some information that you're going to need. It's a holiday shortened weekend coming up, of course, a holiday shortened week coming up over the next week, as Monday, the markets in the U.S. are closed for the celebration of President's Day. So what are we going to talk about? Well, we have to talk about some of the economics that are going on that we saw last week. Obviously, markets hitting some new highs. Before we get to that, I'll mention I was at the Miami Boat Show this weekend. I haven't been there in some time. Usually I try to get to the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show. Historically, I mean, for many, many years, the Miami Boat Show was the place to go. It was a place to see the new designs, the new boats, all the new accessories, whether it was electronics or anything related to boating, sailing, etc. You know, they had great booths that were at the Miami Beach Convention Center, and they would have in-water shows up and down the areas of Miami Beach and some a little bit further away, but nothing major. It kind of was somewhat, I would say, easy to get around and to navigate this whole boat show. Well, it's changed. Over the last few years, the Miami Boat Show got a little crazy. I mean, I had to go down, which was pretty far away from where it used to be. It's now down in Key Biscayne, and traffic is one way in, one way out. And trying to get there during the morning, even with and without rush hour, it was terrible. I mean, the traffic was awful. And the boat show was much smaller. There were some really cool designs. Now they have boats that are expanding the ranges of sizes in terms of how they're designed. It used to be that, you know, these big cabin cruisers were really big, of course. They'd have the big ones there, which they still do. But now the fishing boats, they're, you know, it used to be, I don't know, maximum 32, 33 feet, 34 feet for the open fishermen, the, you know, the ones that you see down in Florida. Now they're getting towards 50 and 60 feet is what we're seeing with outboard engines. For those of you not interested in boating, well, you have no idea probably what I'm talking about or no care about what I'm talking about. But what I found most interesting from an economic standpoint was that the pricing on some of these things have gone through the roof. And if you happen to want to buy a new boat and you said, I like this. Yeah, I'm going to buy it right now. I'm going to put down a deposit. These boats are taking upwards of a year and a half to actually build. The backlog on new boats is incredible. And that shows a very strong market for new boats. And it is actually, we're seeing a very strong market for used boats. So both things are really playing pretty strongly right now, which goes to a component of the economics and economic environment that is showing that there is underlying strength for excess supply or demand for goods, really. The excess, even though there is supply out there, there's a tremendous amount of demand for, we'll say, discretionary items. So the underpinnings of the economy is still strong in certain areas when it comes to high-end and high-priced consumer discretionary items. And that's something that's obviously good to see. Now, getting back to markets for a second. Let me just say one other thing. So my take on this is that I will not go to the Miami show again. It was not as it really wasn't. It was nice, but again, miserable from a traffic standpoint and from a logistical standpoint, impossible to get around without really spending some money on either Ubers or taxis, or if you wanted to wait for a water taxi between the various places that they had set up for the in-water shows. But just it's not what it used to be. Now the show is the Fort Lauderdale show, and I've been there several times over the last few years. And I got to tell you, if you have an opportunity, if you're down here when the Fort Lauderdale boat show is going on, that is something you want to check out. That's awesome. Really a lot of fun. We also have the South Beach Food and Wine Festival happening this week. I'll give you a report next week. I have two different events that we'll be going to, and both are very exciting. One is they call it cobayo, which is it translates roughly to guinea pigs in English from Spanish. And this is where we don't know what's being served, who's serving it. We don't know anything about it. We're just showing up. And there's probably about five or maybe upwards of eight different chefs that will be preparing dinner that night, showing their best of all. Andrew Zimmern on Sunday night will be having a block party. Now, what he's doing is he's closing off a whole area in South Beach in Miami and turning it into as he calls it, a nighttime Asian street food market. That's going to be fun. I'll tell you all about that next week. Let's get to some of the things that are going on in the markets here in the U.S. and what's happening in terms of the economics. And there's clearly the continuation of markets keeping a bid, not giving up anything. I mean, really not giving up one little bit, a little bit of a hiccup, we'll call it, on Thursday. And pre-market futures were down a couple of times. And when markets opened up, they just ramped right, tremendously higher. We saw that the U.S. market was again one of the strongest markets in the world over the week. And this is when we saw that Europe was weak a few times, concerned about some of the elections that are coming up. And there was really no follow through from Europe towards the end of the week, as we did see with the U.S. markets. If you haven't noticed this, it's a really interesting phenomenon that's going on, that when markets open at 9:30 a.m. in the morning, Eastern time, there's an immediate flow of funds. I mean, you could see it on the futures. You could see it on the markets. They spike up dramatically. Now, sometimes they've been flattening out a little bit and kind of from about, I would say about 10 o'clock in the morning or so, until about 3:30 in the afternoon, flatlining, not much happening from wherever the initial move was on the market that day. But then another move, oftentimes higher, just to close. It could maybe only be a small amount, but still, there is clearly very little concern about any of the news flow, economics, earnings, and geopolitical environment on a global basis that we're seeing from investors. I mean, there really is no concern because we're seeing them buy on the open and continue to buy on the close. That's a sign, at least for the time being, that there is very little concern about what's happening. Now, there is maybe a little bit of concern about some of the volume that we've seen that hasn't been as high as people would like to see. But yet, at the same time, it's all about price, right? At the end of the day, prices have been higher. In fact, it's interesting to look at some of the internals and the statistics of the markets. Now, the question is, why aren't volumes there? Is it that there's a lack of interest? Is it that there's no motivation? I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are a lot fewer shares in the market these days. Now, that's not all of the reason why, but think about this for a second. We've talked about this so many times that over the years, there have been this continuation of share buybacks at a very healthy clip. Company after company is going out and borrowing money or using funds they have to buy back shares in their companies. Some companies I've seen, buying back 30 to 40% of their company over the last several years, with no secondaries, meaning that the actual amount of shares that are outstanding that are available to trade in the open markets have been just done away with. And when that happens, there are less shares on the open market, company by company, and as a market in its entirety to actually trade. Now, when you have that going on, you have to say, well, what does that mean? The first thing it means, obviously, is that you'll probably see less volumes because you have, while you have maybe some of money trading and chasing various names, but there's a lot less going on out there to be purchased. What that also means is that if there is a bid to markets and if there is a desire to buy markets or an individual stock, what happens is that it is the same amount of money chasing fewer shares. And as you're chasing fewer shares, well, what happens? Simple. It moves shares directionally on the buy side higher at a quicker pace or lower if they're selling at a quicker pace on the downside. Now, we haven't seen a situation recently at all where there's been a sell-off that has been substantial because there's been a continuation of this buying, hoping for the benefit of tax benefits, lower corporate taxes, etc. Now, when we do see, and if we do see, markets always cycle, we know this, when we do see something that has changed, and maybe it will be after the release of the actual tax plan, whenever that comes, supposedly in the next week or so, maybe there'll be a sell the news concept instead of buying the rumor. And maybe it won't be as strong. Maybe it will be better. Whatever the case may be, let's see the next time there is a sell-off, if it is as dramatic and as quick as we've seen with the recent buys. In other words, when people are looking to unload shares, and since there are less shares on the open market, will they be doing so by pushing down prices that much faster because there's that much pressure? It's opposite of what we're seeing today. Now, here are some of the internals that I think that are very interesting to look at. In terms of the S&P 500, about 374 stocks, their prices are above their 200-day moving average. And that's pretty much towards the high side that we've seen over the last 2 years or so. Not the highest we've seen, but pretty good, where you're seeing that this is an uptrend above the 200-day, oftentimes above the 50-day, or at least close to. Now, some of the numbers are very much higher skewed above, multiple standard deviations above their 200-day moving average, which you don't see very often. And that's why a lot of people are starting to say that markets are getting quite overbought. That's one of the things that people are using as their reasoning, that markets are, you know, quite frothy. Now, whether they are or not, this is just one piece of information. Now, before the election, there was only about 225 stocks that were above their 200-day moving average. So we're seeing a lot of stocks are participating or had been participating in this market move. However, what's also interesting to see is that the McClellan Oscillator, and if you haven't really studied or taken the time to take a look at what is going on and what is the importance of the McClellan Oscillator, which essentially is a measure of advancers and decliners and how much over time and some trends that you see, it's below zero again. Tom McClellan puts out a great newsletter, by the way. If you can get a freebie, just look up Tom McClellan and you'll see the information there of his newsletter. And he talks about the oscillator each and every day and makes a lot of market calls on a timing basis that is based on this oscillator. Because when you see that there is a situation where we have new highs in the markets, at the same time, the McClellan oscillator starts to show a divergence to move below zero, meaning that there is a lack of participation currently, most recently, over the last few days, with stocks in general moving markets. What it says is that there is the largest companies by capitalization that are really the ones responsible for moving the markets. Because if we saw this, over about 2 years ago, year and a half ago. Same situation where the biggest of big stocks are the ones that are really participating in the rally and moving markets higher because they have that much of an overweight in the indices. And therefore, we're seeing that markets are moving up, but yet there's not a lot of underlying participation. Now, again, there has been participation since the election in a big way. But most recently, that dynamic has changed a little bit. Now, that's not reason to be all up in arms and alarmed and concerned about anything impending that's going to be horrible. But still, at the same time, that's something to be aware of. The other thing that I like to look at in terms of where are things on this, the spectrum of markets being too hot, needing a time to consolidate, digest some of the recent gains, is the Spearman indicator. And it's at one of the highest levels I've seen in some time. It's 98.7. I've seen about 100, 102. But once you get above the 90 range, it usually signals an overbought condition that needs to either consolidate or digest, which means that people will kind of wait and see what's going on until we see that next leg. Where does it usually resolve? Well, it could resolve either direction. More recently, we've seen that there has been a momentary sell-off when we see levels above, let's say, 95 on the Spearman. And then from there, what happens is that we see the next leg higher. That's what's been going on over the last several months. Question is, at 98.7, you can look at it as the temperature of the markets, if you will. Is that something that's going to, at this point, be the resolution lower, combining that with the fact that we're seeing all these companies above their 200-day and some of them significantly over their 200-day statistically in, again, a standard deviation basis, so high comparatively, and now market participation being condensed to many of just the largest capped companies out there. So what's next? As a matter of fact, this is a question that I have seen from many people via emails and clients writing, what's going on? Telephone calls I've had with them. What's next? Where are we going from here? So this is what I'm telling them. Essentially, right now, there's tremendous optimism. I mean, just amazing amounts of optimism that are out there with regard to the tax plan that has been, well, say, discussed, thrown out there. The carrot that has been right in front of investors' noses for weeks on end at this point. We have no real details about this. We have some idea that there's going to be some reduction in the tax rate for individuals and for companies, but we really have, I haven't seen any other details. Not only have we not seen details, we don't know who's opposed and who's for this thing in the Congress. We know that, of course, that President Trump has talked about this on and on, about this whole idea, this wonderful tax plan that's going to be in place and it's going to benefit companies, et cetera. But there's no details yet. But there's clearly a tremendous amount of hope that corporate tax rates will drop. And that will mean, essentially, an immediate benefit to the bottom line to companies. Now, you think about this for a second. If we're going to, again, an example, if we're going from a tax rate of 35% for a company down to, let's say, 25% or 20%, that's an immediate and instantaneous benefit to their earnings and their margin. They don't have to change anything. They don't have to do anything. They don't have to make more money. They don't have to change their product line. This is an immediate benefit to their earnings, and that's why you're seeing the pricing of stocks move up the way they have been, because the anticipation of some kind of beneficial tax code plan to them, a reduction. I'm not even talking about simplification here. I'm not talking about anything more than just a reduction in the tax rate. Think about it on your own situation. You don't do anything different. You're working hard, making money. You have your stocks. You have your portfolio. You don't do anything. You're not trading. You're doing nothing. But all of a sudden, we're seeing that your tax rate is cut by, let's say, 20 or 30%. you have immediately more money to spend or save or do whatever you want with just by the simple fact that there is a cut to your taxes. And that can't be a bad thing. There's no reason to believe that if there is a tax cut, that somehow it won't move back into the economy in some way or another. Even if companies don't spend that money, even if they don't go and build factories or add employees, if nothing changes, that earnings number is going to expand. Now, of course, there's a lot of things that can offset some of this. The question is, well, if we do see a tax plan that in fact does reduce taxes down for corporations, is there going to be an offsetting factor such as a border tax? Is this whole protectionism environment going to offset some of the benefits from taxes? Well, yeah, that's what they say. If it's going to be in place, that is going to, in fact, curtail some of the earnings power and earnings momentum from some companies. Those companies that have, in particular, offshored a lot of their product manufacturing, if they're going to bring it back here, it's going to probably increase the pricing factors. So there may be some offsetting factors on this. It's not going to be, I think, just, you know, peaches and cream and we're going to get a tax break and nothing else is going to be affected, because a lot of other moving parts involved here that if it gets in force, it will show a big concern. You know, retailers have been riding the wave and falling on the viability and potential for a border tax. But as we are seeing it right now, investors, as I've said time and time again, that are seeing the glass as full, that everything is going to come into play and it's all going to be beneficial to the bottom line of companies. And therefore, we might as well just keep on buying stocks, even with bad news, even with the fact that the Fed was much more hawkish last week. If you look at the testimony and the testimony, the press conference that went on, questions that went on from Congress and the analysis of what they said with regard to the quantitative easing program and the roll-off or non-roll-off of the bonds that they have in their portfolio, and the fact that they're going to probably have, at least they say, another three hikes this year, which could be at least in the March meeting, at least one of them. That didn't seem to bother markets either. Yeah, bonds sold off a little bit in that whole discussion, but came right back, and bonds were being bought again towards the end of the week. So even with this idea that we're going to see higher interest rates, because we did see a significant bump to both the producer price index and the CPI, both of those saw a significant bump last week. That being the case, obviously the Fed should be, we don't know, but should be on the lookout for higher inflation, which is one of their mandates and one of the things that they're very concerned about. We will see the deficit hawks and the inflation hawks in Congress put up the red flag if we seek a continuation of this. And if, in fact, we do get this tax break, the inflation will probably continue to move higher, therefore signaling the Fed to raise at a faster rate, or at least raise at the rate that they had initially put in for this year, which was four total rate hikes in 2017. So that could be a headwind, a little bit of a roadblock for higher earnings. Companies won't be able to borrow as cheaply anymore to do more buybacks. But again, they'll have more cash available because they'll have tax. So there are some offsetting factors in all this. We have to keep aware of that. Let's kind of segue right now into what's going on in terms of, or what went on, first of all, in terms of economics last week, because I think it was really interesting. And then we're going to get some listener questions. By the way, you can follow me over on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. One word is the Twitter handle. If you have any questions at all, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you could just simply click on the Ask Andrew button. And you can then just ask a question or give a comment about the show. We'll try to get your questions answered one way or the other, either directly if it's kind of a personal matter or if it's something that I think is worthwhile for the rest of our audience. Of course, we'll do so. We're going to talk about a variety of comments and questions today, as a matter of fact. And if, for whatever reason, you're saying, you know, maybe it's time we take a look at an alternative investment idea, something that you know, maybe is not your simple buy and hold 401k style that you're doing right now that you've done very well with probably with the buy and hold, check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy and the Arrow Strategy, which is an algorithmic trading strategy. All the information is on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You could also get a virtual tour, a quick video of what is the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. So, you know, if you're kind of have been thinking, well, I've been thinking maybe now's the time. Maybe now's the time. Markets are a little bit hot right now. I want to look at a strategy that can actually go short, bring up cash, you know, look at only certain areas that are in the market for benefiting throughout this time, looking at hedging out some of the risk in a portfolio, looking at maybe short, long, and neutral type of strategies. You got that all in the Arrow and the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, TDIMG, we call it, over on the Disciplined Investor. Go check that out. All right, so let's talk about some of the things we saw from an economic standpoint last week. I mentioned that we did see in the beginning of the week that PPI came out at 0.6% on a month-over-month basis. The forecast was somewhere between 0.2 and 0.3. Last month's was also revised higher, ever so slightly. But basically, what we saw was that the PPI, which is the producer price index, which is the manufacturing inflation, the cost of goods and the cost of things that go into the manufacturing process before the end consumer actually buys it, was up 0.6%. Now, obviously, if we were to annualize that, we're seeing a 7% rate of inflation, which is pretty hot on a wholesale level. Now, will that play, or is it 1 month that was just a little bit of an aberration, or is it something that we're going to see moving forward? I think that number has the Fed kind of spooked it, to be honest with you. It would seem to me that when we look at a number like that, which is double the anticipated amount, especially in an environment that we have now, that should be something that raises some eyebrows and gets the Fed a little bit concerned, especially with the fact that the next day on Wednesday, we saw that the consumer price index or in the inflation rate was also at 0.6%. Expectations were for about 0.3%. Core CPI, when you strip out some things, was at 0.3%. But still, if you annualize that, we're still at 3.6%. So any way you want to look at this, inflation is absolutely moving higher. No question about this. Now, retail sales, we saw that also popped better than expected. We've been seeing this, you know, anywhere from 0.5% to 1%. Expectations were a little bit of a drop down as we are coming off of the holiday season month, right? When you look at a month over month, obviously December should have been one of the higher months that we've seen, but yet we look at January, and oftentimes in January and into February, you can expect a little bit of a drop off. Everybody kind of did what they could and bought all the things they could for the holidays, and now all of a sudden start the year and they're going to slow down. They're going to save money. They're going to not need to buy as many things and gifts, of course. But we did see that retail sales were up about 0.4%, which beat estimates handily. Estimates were for about a 0 to a 0.1%. A couple other things that were interesting, I thought were, retail sales ex auto was up 0.8%. So if you strip out auto, now all of a sudden we're seeing it even higher. Obviously, autos dragged a little bit. Industrial production was actually down a little bit, which I thought was interesting. There was seemingly a tremendous amount of inventory builds over the last several quarters, and that kind of slowed down right now. Maybe all the sales that we saw throughout the holidays dissipated, orders weren't coming in as much, and now factories are slowing down ever so slightly in terms of the inventory side of things. Housing starts came in. This was on Thursday. A little bit better than expected. Building permits came in also better than expected. Initial claims are still low at 239,000, seeing some of the lowest initial claims on an average basis weekly that we've seen in years, in decades. So people aren't being laid off. That bodes very well, by the way, for the jobs market. As we're seeing that each and every week when the initial claims, which is a very volatile series, but when it comes out and we're seeing that 239,000, 240,000, even under 250,000, any number, each and every week, that is showing us that there is still a very, very healthy labor market. And we can argue what the number is at 4.8%, 4.7% labor participation rate. Throw that out the window for a second. Just put that aside for a moment. The fact is that we're seeing that there are low initial claims and about 200,000 plus or minus a few 10,000, 20,000 being added to the payrolls each and every month on the official statistics. And again, forget about what in fact is the actual number of unemployment because of all the different statistical anomalies that are involved. But we are seeing that it's still, people are hiring. Companies are hiring. There's no question about that. So the other thing that I thought was interesting is that the Philly Fed, one or two Fed manufacturing numbers that I look at, the regionals, that I think is a very important one to look at, was at 43.5, which was up from 23. Expectations were for 19. So again, there is a good amount of manufacturing in totality going on. Even though we saw that industrial production dropped a little bit and business inventory growth dropped a little bit, the Philly Fed is, I think, a very important one when we look at how the manufacturing composite is doing. That will feed into the ISM manufacturing number that we'll see. Now, coming up next week, we have existing home sales. This will be interesting to watch. We're looking at an annualized rate of about 5.5 million sales. And this is, I think, one of the more important things, along with new home sales that will be at the end of the week. Now, of course, we're still not at the high that we've seen new home sales, but we see business confidence from home builders is at a pretty good high. Now, there's a lot that happens underneath all of this. A lot that happens in terms of existing home sales, new home sales. There's a lot of jobs that are created there. There's a lot of buying that goes on for building supplies, for renovations, for upkeep and maintenance, getting it ready for sale, after the sale remodeling, or touching up or painting or whatever you're doing. And new home sales, the same thing, but from the ground up. So these two numbers next week, I think, are going to be pretty important. Wednesday, we're going to see existing home sales, expectations 5.5 million. At the end of the week, Friday, we're going to see new home sales. Again, expectations about 560,000 for the period. The other things that we'll see during the week, the FOMC minutes, of course, and as we've seen that algos are tied to the buy side whenever there is anything that the Fed says, it could be good or bad, and we'll see the minutes from the for the February meeting that recently happened. So that's what's happening next week. Earnings season is kind of slowing down a bit. Again, right in the ballpark of about 70% of companies have actually beat expectations recently. And from an earnings standpoint, and from a revenue standpoint, about 55-57% have, depending on which particular statistics you look at, have beaten revenues. That's pretty much what we see on a regular basis, time and time again, over the years, over each and every quarter. Now, I did get a good amount of comments and listener questions. I'm just going to kind of buzz through these. I think there were some good ones in here. There's some comments that I'll just read to you and tell you what they're saying. And again, if you have comments or questions, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and click on the Ask Andrew button there and just ask a question. All right, this one's from Peter Winter, and he says, hey, Andrew, a few things. He says, I fly up and down California all the time. Everything is green. The drought is definitely over for now. The Sierras have been the highest snowpack in decades. So I was thinking of California ag stocks that may benefit from the abundance of water. But then I started thinking, well, good growing conditions means lots of supply and therefore lower prices. But it also means a lot more produce, et cetera, can be sold as well. What is your take on this? I think that you have some very good points here, and I think that you're right that the more water, the more farming that goes on, the more crops that are being produced, the lower prices. So therefore, agricultural companies could do well. One of the things that you have to be aware of is that there has been a lot of alternative places to be buying agricultural products throughout the world, frankly, and a lot of things that are going on there. So when you're seeing that there is better conditions for California-based produce, yes, I would say that that probably will benefit them, especially in an environment that right now everything is all about Buy America. Now, I don't know about you. I don't necessarily go over to the fruit aisle and vegetable aisle in my local grocery store and start looking at the labels and wondering, is this from Guatemala? Is it from Panama? Is it from Mexico? Is it from, you know, Chile or Argentina? I don't really necessarily look at that. I just look at what particular fruit has the best flavor, the best look, the pricing. So I think that it may help out the California agricultural companies, which there's only a few really that are located there. A few companies that really are only California. I mentioned Calavo Growers, which is an avocado company that has two or three different facilities and farms in Mexico, but has a tremendous amount of avocados in California. And I think that that was interesting to look at because there has been a tremendous, about a 20% drop in that stock with the idea that there's going to be sanctions and a border tax, et cetera. So, you know, what's going to happen is, and this is what happens with this kind of product, dependent on where it's cheaper to buy it from is where it will be bought from. Therefore, if the crops are really good and prices are down because there's an abundance of supply, it's going to be probably bought from companies that are in that area. If the prices are higher, they'll buy from somewhere else. Now, the other thing that happens is that companies will, in fact, start producing from their locations in wherever the benefit is, that they can actually get it cheaper and then sell it. So you reach an equilibrium with some of this stuff. So realize that I don't think it's just about necessarily the growing conditions right now, particularly when it comes to, we'll call it vegetables and agriculture. It has a lot more to do with the weather, but also some of the tendencies of this whole Buy America right now. So keep your eye on that as well as the rainfall. He also asked if Trump offered you the Fed chair position in 2008, would you take it? No, I don't want to be involved in the government. This is from Jack C. Jack C said, hey, Andrew, I bought your book some time ago. It was an old edition when I had the mustache on my book cover picture. He said, I misplaced it when we moved and then purchased the audio version recently. Since I have long commute every day, just want to say I enjoy listening to your audiobook as well as your podcast. Thank you. He said, a couple of episodes ago, you mentioned URRE, which is a uranium stock. He said, I like the outlook for uranium. It can't get worse, it seems, especially after I saw Trump's energy-centric cabinet members. But URRE dropped significantly earlier this year after the public offering at about $2 a share. It dropped further when announced the plan to issue shares to retire debt to increase and improve compensation incentive plans. I just don't like the sound of this. It looks like management doesn't care much about the investors. What's your take? Are you investing in the company? I think we talked about this with Frank Curzio last week, this particular company. One of the things you have to realize, this is a company that if they do, in fact, find a mine that is rich with uranium and they start either selling off the rights or producing on it, we'll see a tremendous benefit. But until such time, they're in the discovery phase and they have a few things here and there. But what I'm saying is that they have to keep on bringing in money in order to do the R&D, if you will. And that's what's going on here. The pure play in the uranium area is Cameco. Hopefully everybody's happy I finally said that correctly. Not Cameco, as I was corrected and scolded by many of you. Cameco. CCJ. Now, URRE is very speculative. They did offering after offering after offering. Recently, they did a private deal that's dropped the stock a little bit, but they've still been holding it about this $2 line. We'll call it anywhere from about $190 to $2. Very speculative. Very, very speculative. If you want to look at a pure play uranium company, they all have problems because uranium, the price of uranium has dropped to just incredible levels. Starting to pick up a little bit here, but CCJ is a better one to look at from that, in that respect. Craig Sherwood writes, he was saying, you know, with all the Supreme Court picks coming up, I'm thinking long coal companies and small cap longs based on a business friendly pick. What are your thoughts? Yeah, I mean, obviously, right now there's another recent presidential. He just put in another order that was pretty much lifting some of the coal, the headwinds for the coal industry in terms of pollution, et cetera. That was just put into play. Look at these coal companies. They've come out of what looks like a bankruptcy almost. Have you seen the stocks? I mean, take a look at these. So coal is an interesting play right now. I still wonder how much it's going to be readopted after all of this clean energy is out there. But it's interesting. I think that, yes, of course, in a business-friendly environment, especially with tax cuts and still a low interest rate environment, that small caps, and as we can see about what's going on with small caps, has been a good place to be. John Marty wrote, hey, Andrew, I was first introduced to you and your work by Frank Curzio, and I've rapidly become a big fan of yours. However, I was surprised and disappointed in your interview with Harry Dent. You were way too easy on him. How can anyone believe what he writes or says? He was one of the ones that predicted the Dow would hit 35,000. 2 years ago, he wrote a book predicting a huge stock market collapse followed by a global depression. And that was supposed to start in May of 2015. He also said that real estate would lose 40% of its value and gold would drop to $700 an ounce, all in the same time frame. And then he said, if this doesn't occur, it would be delayed until early 2020s. Now, in his new book, he's out with more Chicken Little predictions, and I'm sure he's prepared to revise as necessary. Harry Dent is the greatest fiction writer of our time. Listen, I bring on people of all different opinion to bring out what is, you know, hopefully going to be a broad-based look at all sides of the equation. Unfortunately, sometimes, and I'm not really directing this at Harry Dent or anybody else, but unfortunately, what really sells is sensationalism. Crazy predictions. That's how you get on CNBC and Bloomberg, and you know, you get on the nightly business hour. You don't just say, well, yeah, I agree with everybody else, and they say, oh, get that guy on. Oh, he has a book? Wait, his book says that he agrees with everybody else? Get him on right now. It doesn't go like that. It's the outliers. It's those that are very much outside the norm, outside the ranges that get the attention and therefore you to buy their various products. It's very hard to just be a fish in an ocean of people that are saying the same thing and get any notice. Got to be the guy in the outer rim. That's the guy that gets the hook. So I will continue to bring on Harry Dent just to get his information because I think there is some very good, aside from his predictions that are based on a time frame, I think that many of his economic points are something to be looked at and something to be taken very seriously. Some of the things about what's going on in China, their economy, how it's held up, essentially a house of cards. What's going on with the debt bubble? I think there's some very good points that he brings up that we need to hear. Now, whether or not it's going to collapse in 2017, 2020, or ever, if there is going to be any of these horrific results of any of this, I think it's important that we know about these things rather than shut them out because, you know, his time-based prediction. So if we could just think of it that way, I think that we can absorb this much better. So when I deal with some of the outliers out there that are looking at all the things that could go wrong, let's just look at that and put that in, you know, file it away. And yeah, that is something that we want to look at so that we're not surprised if it actually happens. Caleb Thomas writes me, hey, Andrew, I enjoy the show. Thanks for it. Thanks for listening. I appreciate that. What do you think about the short float for CVGW? Sitting about 19% seems quite high, but I'm not always quite sure about how to interpret that piece of info when analyzing the stock. Any thoughts and insights will be well appreciated. Let's just really focus, not on this stock, but let's focus on the whole idea of short interest for a second. I think that's really the point here. Short interest can be looked at two ways. I think that the very novice investor looks at short interest as a confirmation that a lot of people are betting against the company, which can be true. And therefore they say, you know what? I don't want to be a part of this. Now, also, I think the short-term trader, so I'm going to give you different scenarios here. The short-term trader, the swing trader, the day trader, the scalp trader looks at short interest and says, wow, a very high short interest can be really looked at as something very beneficial. Because we do know two things about being short a stock. First, there's a limited downside. Stocks don't go below zero or bankrupt. There's an unlimited upside. Stocks can go up forever. They can split, go back up, split, go back up. But there's a limited amount of money that you can make if you, in fact, are short. It could go to zero. I don't care how many times it splits, it can go to zero. So now, when we look at short interest from a short-term trader standpoint, it can be very beneficial because they look for catalysts that can actually take the stock higher, create a short squeeze if, in fact, the short interest is high enough. And therefore, what that does is it creates a potential short-term catalyst to make some nice money and to scalp a trade. The long-term trader, the fundamental trader, will look at this and say, you know, there must be a reason, or there could be a reason, better said, there could be a reason why there is all this short interest. Why are all these people betting against it? And realizing that over the short term, we could see a short squeeze if there is any news that is against the sell side, if you will, the short side. The long-term prospect of this could be very high for me to actually make money on the short side. So again, I think it depends on where you are in the spectrum. Being involved short in a stock that has a high short interest, like into earnings or into an announcement, is very dangerous. Look at what's going on with some of these reverse splits. Remember we talked about these several episodes ago, that these reverse splits with high short interest, how they're moving 50, 60, 70% a day. We saw dry ships go from what, $1 to $100 in a matter of a week and a half. This is only weeks ago, by the way, probably a couple of months ago, split a few times back down to like four, which is, by the way, like 30 cents, 40 cents. So it went from $1 to $100 back to like 40 cents. Another person is writing. Peter's writing me about how to say Cameco. Okay, thanks, Pete. Core Peterson says, Andrew, I think a more in-depth look at repatriation of funds could be interesting conversation. Macroeconomic impact with the conversation of large amounts of funds to the U.S. could impact Forex and the strength weakness of the dollar against other currencies. The extra cash on hand in U.S. companies to redeploy would impact stock values. It seems like there should be some investing opportunities to look for if that happens. And clearly, yes, Core, there is no question that this is something that has been looked at as very advantageous. I think initially, when many of the players were looking at, and the politicians looking at, the repatriation of assets outside of the U.S., what they were thinking was, oh, look at this. We're going to get all this money back into the U.S., and what's going to happen is they're going to redeploy it. How will they do it? Well, they're going to do capital expenditures. They're going to increase their footprint in terms of factories. They're going to employ so many more people. And it's going to be really great because they're going to reinvest it back in the U.S. and create an incredible amount of opportunity and GDP growth. When it was further analyzed, and this was all being put into the idea of how this would work out, many company management said, no, we're not going to expand our capital expenditure. No, we're not going to maybe necessarily hire more. No. We're going to take that money and we're going to do what we do best. We're going to buy back more of our stocks. And if interest rates go higher and it's no longer advantageous for companies to borrow, if that gets to the point where it's no longer advantageous for companies to borrow money, issue debt, and buy back and retire shares, this repatriation comes in very handy. Sure, there'll be a tax, you know, one-time penalty on this to bring it back to the U.S. And what do you look at? Why is Apple moving up so dramatically? Is it because this much, you know, an anticipation of the iPhone 7S or the iPhone 8 or something? Is it that? Is it because their sales were so dramatic and so great? I don't think so. Is it because they have a new design of something brand new that's coming out to the market? No. Dominance in iPad? No, definitely not. So what is it? It's this war chest, this incredible amount of money that they have on hand. That what they can do is now, if repatriation comes into play, if the tax rate goes down, these two things are very beneficial. Okay, let's see here. Mike Bress, he says, I'm new to investing, started December, and I'm comparing two stocks in which I invest, Cisco and Hewlett Packard. I'd like to hear your analysis on which stocks you would go from a value strategy. I currently have no technology stocks within my portfolio. My current approach is a mix of growth and value. It'd be interesting to get your take on these two stocks to help my education, and I'm leaning towards Cisco because the financial outlook are strong, and I feel they're moderately priced at the $30 range. I will tell you that I'm not going to go into all this right now, but I think we answered this in an email, I believe. Cisco Systems has a much better fundamental backdrop. Hewlett Packard clearly has been split into a couple of different companies. But basically, when you look at this, I would look at that company. What I would be looking at is the company that can have better earnings growth over time, year over year, quarter over quarter, better margin expansion, and consistency of revenue growth. Those three things, there's a few other things, but those three things, compare those, put those together, look at what they've done by themselves, how they have improved. And we know that Hewlett Packard has had significant problems. That's why they had to split the company. That's why management has said, you know what, we need to do something different because we have big problems here. So yeah, maybe one side of the Hewlett Packard equation is better than the other, no question about that. But Cisco Systems, it seems, is a perennial, just a winner. Again, I'm not going to get into all the details of that. We got some very long ones in here too. Listen, let's see here. This is too long. Thank you for your emails for E. Dumas. Very, very long. Talked about the Alberta election and Caterpillar and, you know, what's going on with that. He also mentioned that if Trump lasts 4 years, I give $100 Canadian to a charity of your choice, be it the Florida Pulled Pork Eaters Association or whatever it is. I guess he doesn't like Trump. So anyway, Ed, I read your stuff. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. William, I don't have a last name here. He says, there's some speculation that we may end up with a weaker dollar. If that happens, which stocks will be most affected? Well, if we have a weaker dollar, you have to look at the commodity-based stocks, oil-related, natural gas, clearly uranium, gold miners. So you look at all the commodity plays. It all depends on what happens after we have a border tax or not, after we have a tax benefit and tax plan or not. So the weaker dollar issue, I think, is very important. The only negative you have is, do you really want to bet on a weaker dollar right now? If we have the Fed that is seemingly being more aggressive and more hawkish, and we have a tax plan that's going to come into play, I'm not necessarily sure you want to bet on that. I don't really see that as an option that is a smart option. It may happen. And I think that, I've talked about this many times, we're long the gold miners right now. We've been in and out for the last several months. And right now we have a pretty good gain on these companies. And if you look at gold and how gold has played recently, even with a relatively stronger dollar, gold has been kind of holding up pretty well. I'm talking about day to day here. I would continue to watch gold. I think if you see a spark of geopolitical concern like we've been seeing, if you see even the dollar weaken a little bit, kind of like we've been seeing, even with the Fed being hawkish, the gold hasn't really sold off. So take a look at the commodity-based companies, oil, et cetera. And finally, from Ognion Topolov, said, I've been regular listening to your show since the great financial crisis. Well, that's great. That's a long-time listener. The most valuable aspects of your programming for me have been the interviews with vast spectrum of investment professionals. Good examples was the hyperinflationist John Williams and the uber deflationist Harry Dent. At least you're merciful enough to have these listeners not to get these two on the same show. I'm not joking, as I get respect and have respect for each of them, as well as the epic battle of inflation versus deflation. On a side note, isn't it ironic that one of the greatest shows these days, Game of Thrones, is based on the saga, A Song of Ice and Fire? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Getting back to the question you asked the audience, are you okay with the president going after car companies and arm wrestling them to move their production to the U.S.? As a person who voted for Trump and who is sympathetic to the voters, the short answer is no, and for many reasons. From economic point of view, it is not right in a free market spirit, etc. It is something that I could expect from Chinese politicians, but not from the White House of the U.S., not presidential. So that's something, the question we had talked about. Anyway, thanks for all of this. I appreciate your kind words and your insights on this. Again, we have a short week coming up with the the holiday, President's Day. So it'll be a lackluster Tuesday. Although, of course, the highlight of Tuesday, if you don't know about this, the highlight of every Tuesday is DH Unplugged. Myself and John C. Dvorak talk about all things financial news, business, and in a way you probably haven't heard, it's a little bit more on the comedic side, at least from a business standpoint, a little lighter, we'll say lighter side. It actually is live also. We stream it live 9 p.m. Just go over to dhunplugged.com and you could listen in. Well, that's all I got this week. Thanks for all of your listener emails. There was plenty more that we answered directly. But again, you can send me your questions or your comments at any time. Thanks so much, and we appreciate it. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.